Shopify is a global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. And sell more with less effort thanks to the Shopify magic, your AI-powered all-star. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/redcircle, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/redcircle now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/redcircle.
The NFL playoffs are better with FanDuel because right now new customers can bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets. Guaranteed. That's $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. FanDuel, an official sportsbook partner of the NFL. 21 plus and present in select states. First online real money wager only. $5 first deposit required. Bonus issued as non-withdrawable bonus bets which expire 7 days after receipt. Restrictions apply. See terms at sportsbook.fanduel.com. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Hello, and welcome to the Latin American History Podcast. Episode 160. A very brief history of post-conquest Latin America. Part 1. The Colonial Era. A little while ago, I decided to stop releasing this podcast episodes chronologically. And since then, we've looked at a variety of subjects across the geographical spread of Latin America, and of course, across time. I always try to introduce each topic with context so that it makes sense. I do realise, however, that without each episode building on the last, as it did when the episodes were chronologically, it might be harder to place each story within the wider history. Some of you, I presume, are knowledgeable when it comes to Latin America and its history, but I know from emails I receive that some of you enjoy this podcast because the material is all new. I've decided to dedicate the next few episodes towards a series covering the beginning of the colonial period, which is where we stopped doing things chronologically, and tracing Latin America up to the present day. The idea is that if you listen to the latest episodes of this podcast as they come out, or if you discover this podcast sometime in the future and listen to it from the beginning, then this series will provide some of that missing context and help you place future episodes within the wider story. Now, of course, there is so much that this won't cover. Many, many future episodes worth of information and stories. You can assume that all of that will be covered in more detail at some point, as will the things mentioned within this series. The idea is to provide an overview of the basic trends which shaped each era, so that those future stories make a bit more sense, and you have an idea of what was going on at the time and directly before them. Having started writing it, I estimate that this series will run for 7 episodes, but it may expand as I finish writing it. This first one, then, is about the colonial period. If the Spanish conquests ran from 1492, when Columbus first reached the Americas, to let's say the 1550s, when Valdivia was conquering Chile, the colonial period would of course run much longer. These divisions between periods are arbitrary to a certain extent. Columbus didn't do any conquering on his first voyage, and as we saw in recent episodes on the conquests of the Yucatan, Petén in Guatemala, far northern Mexico, and New Mexico, in some places the process wouldn't properly begin for decades. Much of Patagonia wouldn't ever properly be Spanish. It would be Argentina and Chile which extended their territories to the south of the continent. I think, though, that with Valdivia's admittedly shaky conquests in Chile, and with the discovery of silver in north-central Mexico at roughly the same time, the vast majority of Spanish America had been conquered at this point, and the parts of the region which would be most important to their empire were now being consolidated. As we've seen in episodes on Brazil, the Portuguese had more or less established the beginnings of their colonial system, and many of the most important cities had now been founded, even if large parts of the interior were still outside of their control in real terms. So if that conquest period lasted about a human lifetime, a remarkable feat when you consider how much territory this involved, The colonial period, which resulted from it, lasted for another 250 to 275 years. Again, this is a rough statement, based on that 1550s end date for the conquests. Some of those earliest conquests, like that of Hispaniola, were fully under Spanish control for most of that conquest period. The colonial era began with consolidation of the conquests, and resulted in Spain in particular, but Portugal as well, becoming perhaps the most powerful nations in Europe and the world. The head start they got when it came to building empires put them ahead of their contemporaries like England, France, and the Netherlands for a very long time. It was during this period, of course, that the Spanish and Portuguese characters of Latin America were forged. It was when the beautiful colonial buildings were built, when the Iberian languages were made the dominant ones, and when Catholicism was imposed on the indigenous people. There were two backbones to the colonial economy. We will return to the second one soon, but the first was the plantation. While more conventional food-producing agriculture was also important, cash crops like sugar, tobacco, and later coffee fetched huge profits back in Europe. We've already looked at the encomienda system in previous episodes, in which land was handed out to Spaniards alongside an allotment of indigenous people to work it. It didn't take long for this to technically be abolished, although in practice it would continue in places. And so, we have to talk about two of colonial Latin America's other major features, which helped to define the structure of its society. The encomiendas were replaced by what were called reductions. Under this system, indigenous people were put into church settlements, rather than private, profit-oriented, agricultural encomiendas. Just as in Europe, Catholicism was fundamental to the lives of Latin Americans, and society was oriented around it. Converting people to the religion was part of the Iberians' reasoning for creating their empire. Missionaries spread out across the region, seeking out the remote places in search of new souls to save. The bulk of this was done by powerful orders, such as the Dominicans, the Franciscans, and the Jesuits, all of whom held great power in Europe as well. They established themselves in the major population centres, building huge and beautiful cathedrals and churches, but also ventured out into those remote places, like the Amazon, the uncolonised plains of Argentina and Paraguay, and the deserts of the north of Mexico. In many ways, they were successful in converting non-Christians. Many indigenous and African peoples lost their gods and religious traditions, although some indigenous peoples do retain their beliefs to this day. In many places, that conversion was only partial. One of the defining cultural elements of Latin America is syncretism. This can refer to the combining of any kind of tradition. We saw this in the episodes on music, with many genres combining elements from Europe, Africa, and the Americas. In the strictest sense, syncretism is often used to refer to the blending of religions. There are many examples of this in Latin America. Take the miners of Potosí, who forced to descend underground to mine silver and to accept Christianity, equated the devil with their own religious figures as they entered this hell, and who still make offerings to a figure known as El Tío, a devil-like figure. Santería, Umbanda, and Candomblé are examples of religions where West African orishas, or deities, are hidden behind images of Christian saints. Much of these traditions were and are rejected by the Vatican, but some, such as the Virgin of Guadalupe in Mexico, did find acceptance and have been incorporated into mainstream Catholicism. So to replace the shortfall of labour which the abolition of the encomienda brought about, the Iberians embraced the importation of slaves from Africa. More slaves were taken to Brazil than to all of the British colonies, including the USA, combined. Spanish America also incorporated huge numbers, with most of the enslaved being taken to the plantation regions. As a legacy of this, today the coasts of Colombia, as well as parts of Panama, Venezuela, Ecuador, and Peru, the states of Veracruz and the Costa Chica in Mexico, and the Caribbean islands, particularly Cuba, are areas with pronounced Afro-Latin populations. As we've touched on in previous episodes, there was resistance. Free communities of escapees developed in all of those places. Casual labour was also used, drawn from indigenous reductions and campesino peasant villages. All of this fueled the growth of grand haciendas, large estates based on models established as far back as the Romans and resembling the feudal manors of medieval Europe. The largest of these could be the size of small European countries. There was immigration from Spain and Portugal as well. Generally, few of the most upper classes of Iberians wanted to concern themselves with the colonies, but all the classes below were represented. Many traders who saw their opportunities for social advancement limited by the rigid structures of Europe, but who could make money in the New World, were attracted. So too were the poor, who had little to lose back home, being at the bottom of the pile, but who envisioned a place with ample land, where their Spanishness and Portugueseness would put them above many others in the social scale for the first time. Few of these immigrants were women, at least to begin with, and this was one of the factors that helped undermine attempts to keep the ethnic groups which made up the colonies separate. Pretty quickly, the concept of mestizaje developed, the idea of a population with mixed genetics, part Spanish, part indigenous. Today, much of Latin America's population is mestizo. Of course, the genetics of the African population were also added to this. This was tolerated by the authorities, but a complex hierarchical system was developed to try to track a person's parentage. It was known as the caste system. There were lots and lots of labels under this system, which tried to define how much European, indigenous, and African ancestry a person had. It attempted to go back generations. What caste a person was said to be could affect their rights to move up the social hierarchy. Obviously, with so many children being born of mixed heritage, and then having children with partners who had a different mixed heritage, this soon became very difficult to keep track of, and the system faded out towards the end of the colonial period. This didn't mean that prejudice didn't continue to exist, however. Often it became based on how an official judged your ancestry, based on simply looking at you. So let's go back to that second pillar of the economy, which I mentioned earlier. This was silver. Those conquistadors we have followed on their quests for El Dorados and other mythical cities of gold were generally disappointed. But it wasn't long before the empire did find the metallic wealth it was searching for. Silver was discovered fairly quickly in the Andes of Bolivia, Peru, and Chile, culminating in the discovery of the Cerro Rico at Potosí in 1545. Cerro Rico means rich hill. Today Potosí is a largely forgotten place, its population poor and largely indigenous, and it's situated extremely high up on the Andean high plains. Few besides those with an interest in Latin American history and the backpackers which make their way through Bolivia are aware of it, but I truly believe that it's one of the most consequential places in history anywhere in the world. Among the barren hillsides and the sprawling modern city growth is an old town with colonial buildings so fine they seem to have no business being there. Throughout the colonial period, Potosí produced about a third of all the world's silver, and it was the largest industrial complex on the planet. By the mid-1600s, the city had a larger population than most European capitals. It was followed by the discovery of other rich deposits in Mexico, and places like Guanajuato, Taxco, and Zacatecas in particular. The Inca and Aztec empires had been the largest and most complex polities when the Spanish arrived, and so Mexico and Peru were already the two poles of the empire. These silver finds just ensured that this would be the case throughout the colonial era. Secondary centres like Cartagena in northern Colombia and the Caribbean islands of Hispaniola and Cuba, largely drew their importance from their positions as nodes in the flow of silver, alongside their plantation economies. Later, at the end of the 1600s, Portugal would also experience a metal boom, when gold was found in the mountains north of Rio de Janeiro and São Paulo. Today, the name of the state where this boom took place still translates to general mines. All of this silver made Spain rich and powerful, but much of its wealth passed into the hands of others. It allowed the crown to wage its wars, and much was spent on this rather than on developing the country and the empire. Non-Spanish private bankers also benefited from the wealth. It truly changed the world, surprisingly leading to economic crashes, as inflation was not understood at the time, and all this silver triggered it. Even more surprisingly, much of the silver ended up in China, where it replaced the official paper currency and stimulated a population boom. The Portuguese did well, acting as middlemen, and goods like silk and porcelain went the other way to Europe. The reason so much silver was able to reach China was because of another important feature of Spanish-American history, the Manila Galleons. In 1565, the Spanish conquered the Philippines, and they came to constitute its empire in Asia. Soon a large trade was taking place across the Pacific, the route being between Acapulco in Mexico and Manila. This, along with the flows of silver, marks an important moment in the development of globalization and modernity. For the first time, the whole circumference of the world was connected in a regular and organized manner. Ships crossed the Atlantic between Europe and the Americas, while those Manila galleons did the leg between the Americas and Asia. The Spanish and Portuguese were already regularly rounding the bottom of Africa to their colonies, thus completing the loop from Asia to Europe. A person or a traded good could now make its way across the globe, and this, of course, helped enrich the Spanish further. The establishment of the leg between Europe and the Americas is often called the Columbian Exchange, and it itself changed the course of history and life in both of these places. The sugar I mentioned being grown is an example of a crop which came from the Old World, but once the large stretches of fertile land in the Spanish Empire were found, its production and consumption in the Old World greatly increased. Coffee would follow a similar pattern. Tobacco was indigenous to the Americas, and so once it had been turned into a cash crop, it appeared in the rest of the world. Plenty of other foods crossed the ocean, corn and potatoes being examples from the Americas, while livestock went the other way. Diseases were exchanged as well. Smallpox came from Europe, while syphilis probably reached Europe when Spaniards had caught it in their colonies and took it home with them. On top of this were ideas and technology, most obviously the Spanish and Portuguese religion, government forms, and guns. Those diseases had a terrible effect on the indigenous populations. The largest estimates hold that perhaps 90% of the population of the Americas were wiped out over the colonial period. Some of this would have been due to violence, and of course some of the descendants of some indigenous peoples became mestizo and stopped being indigenous as far as their culture was concerned. Disease, though, was probably the most devastating factor. There is a phenomenon known as the Pacific disease, not an actual disease, but an idea which explains how people in Australia, Melanesia, Polynesia, and surrounding areas reacted to the colonialism imposed on them much later than in Latin America. In short, this theory holds that rates of alcoholism, suicide, obesity, and general bad social outcomes like imprisonment have tended to be high, and the shock of the new situation experienced by this population is used to explain this. Something similar probably occurred in Latin America. Attempts were made to soften policy towards indigenous people. As mentioned, the encomienda was abolished, for example. In reality, though, enforcement and the situation on the ground was uneven.
Shopify is a global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. and sell more with less effort thanks to the Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/redcircle, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/redcircle now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/redcircle.
Access big savings every day, all in the Kroger app.
Get tender Heritage Farm boneless chicken breast for $2.49 a pound. Then find low prices on thousands of items like sparkling ice water, Kroger brand chips, and more, all with your card.
Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
All of this silver, trade wealth, and manpower, of course, made the other European powers jealous. We've already seen the first incursions against the stipulations of the Treaty of Tordesillas, when France made its first attempt to colonize Brazil, on the bay where Rio de Janeiro is today. They would try again there, before moving on to the Caribbean. The Dutch would also control parts of northern Brazil for quite a while, causing the Portuguese a headache. Britain conquered Jamaica and settled other smaller Caribbean islands. Not long after, of course, they and their religious dissidents would found their first colonies in North America, and so the stage would be set for the formation of the USA. Gradually, the Iberians had accepted that they could no longer keep the rest of the Europeans out, but they tried their best to repel them. They also forbade their colonial citizens from trading with non-subjects, which created rampant smuggling and illegal trade. Some of those citizens didn't mind the outsiders turning up, because they brought with them opportunities to make money. This was also the golden age of piracy, and in truth, the lines between official national projects and illegal private criminal ventures were blurry. Sailors like Francis Drake were at times government-commissioned privateers, who were tasked with attacking Spanish trade in times of war. But at other times, they acted alone to enrich themselves by raiding those Spanish ships, taking New World treasure back to Europe. Sometimes they undertook those illegal, unsanctioned ventures with the unspoken approval of European crowns. The Caribbean, in this context often called the Spanish Main, was the heart of this violence, but pirates attacked the Pacific coast as well. We will do plenty of episodes on piracy in this main podcast, but this month's Friends of the Podcast episode looks at the story of one city which suffered multiple pirate raids, and even uneasily hosted an illegal community of retired British buccaneers in the woods, down the coast. Campeche, on Mexico's Yucatan Peninsula, grew rich as one of the main ports through which goods flowed back to Spain, but this also made it a target. As a result, today it's one of only two cities in Central and North America with intact defensive walls, and it is, in my opinion, one of Latin America's most underrated and beautiful colonial cities. So if you want to hear about that, as well as about an account by a British sailor who lived among the pirates, as well as gaining access to a growing archive covering everything from Butch Cassidy's final years in South America to the mysterious civilization of Tiwanaku, there is a link with information about how to sign up and become a friend of the podcast in the description of this episode. Despite all the advantages and wealth which the Spanish Empire gave its mother country, managing it was not always easy, even before considering those attacks from outsiders. There were complex and conflicting interests to be balanced. Most obvious among these were the wishes of the indigenous and African populations, who rebelled periodically. There are too many of these to list here, but the Yucatan and the Mapuche lands of the Southern Cone were particularly rebellious, while there were slave rebellions from time to time, wherever there were large populations of slaves. There were disagreements between priests and colonists as well. Perhaps the largest of these came with the Jesuits. The Jesuit story is both linked to Latin America and apart from it. They were one of the most powerful religious orders in Europe and controlled large areas of land in Latin America. They were particularly powerful on the plains of northern Argentina and Paraguay. Here they had established large religious communities where many indigenous people lived under their protection. This brought them into conflict with settlers who wanted to use these indigenous peoples for their labour and envied their land. Their biggest foes were the Bandeirantes, slave raiders from Brazil who roamed the plains looking for indigenous people to sell back in their major cities. The Jesuits were making a lot of money. In Paraguay and Argentina, for example, they produced huge amounts of mate, the tea-like drink which is hugely popular in that part of the world today. In the end, though, it wasn't just the settlers and slave raiders they were annoying. It was the elite of Europe, and it would be this which led to their downfall. Various kings had begun to fear the economic power of the Jesuits, and perceived them as too willing to challenge them on political matters. In the mid-1700s, the Iberian powers, along with other European nations, made the decision to expel them from their territories, both in Europe and the colonies. Doctrinal religious reasons were often cited, but it was about power and money as much as anything else. This had a devastating impact on peoples like the Guarani of Argentina and Paraguay, as the protection they had enjoyed was withdrawn, and in this case, it led to a collapse of the mate industry, which didn't recover for 100 years. In previous episodes, I've given basic outlines of what was going on in Spain during the early years of its empire. Specifically, we looked at how Ferdinand and Isabella's marriage unified what is now Spain, and at how the Habsburg family ended up in control through inheritance, bringing many other parts of Europe under the control of one person, and later including Portugal for a time due to its own inheritance problems. Habsburg rule had, of course, seen rapid and vast expansion of the empire, and made Spain perhaps the world's greatest power. It also saw the rise of a local ruling administrative class of mayors, priests, and landowners, made up of families born in their part of Spanish America. As we have also seen, the wealth which this generated was not necessarily put to good use, and was spent on things like wars. Like any historical event or phenomenon, there are multiple interpretations of this period, and what followed, and I have not yet studied it all in detail. At some point we will cover the subject, but as I understand it, from what I have read, all that silver coming back to Spain actually created a sort of dependence and discouraged it from growing and innovating. By 1700, Latin America was doing quite well, but Spain itself wasn't. It was basically bankrupt, and its army was tiny, especially considering how big the empire was. Its malaise found a fitting physical metaphor in its royal family. In 1700, King Charles II died, without having produced a child to inherit. Like much of the European aristocracy and royalty, the Habsburgs had married within their own extended family, as a way of gaming the inheritance system and keeping their power and property within the family. This, of course, meant inbreeding, with all the health issues that come with it. Charles was not well from birth, and his inability to have children was a result of this. His death led to the War of Spanish Succession, which lasted 13 years and resulted in the Bourbon family taking control of Spain and its empire. This dynasty is the one from which the Spanish royal family is drawn to this day. The Austrian branch of the Habsburgs had been their opponents in the war, and as part of the peace agreement, they gave up their claims to Spain, but the Bourbons would not control the rest of those European territories which their predecessors had. This might have been bad for their personal power, but it meant that they would face none of the distractions which the Spanish Habsburgs had done. Their attention then was focused on Spain and its colonies, and they set about completely reforming how the empire worked. This was the age of the Enlightenment, of new ideas which sought to replace medieval feudal systems with more modern ones. The idea that a king could rule a group of lands with no connection to each other was going out of fashion. The concept of the nation-state was replacing it, and this was what Spain now became. Alongside this were concepts related to trade and to liberty and individualism, as well as science and quantification. France was one of the places driving this trend, and as the Bourbon family had their roots there, they introduced a lot of these ideas to Spain, as well as the actual people tasked with running the country. The church was separated from the state, not completely, but to a much greater extent than the old feudal alliance, which said that kings rule due to their God-given right. There would be no more wars in Europe based on the defence of Catholicism. In Spain itself, the major change was centralisation. It had grown out of a patchwork of old kingdoms, and so the drive was to integrate them more fully and to direct things from Madrid so that coherent and unified policies could be made. This helped, and the economy started to stabilise. Of course, the same principles were then applied to Spanish America. The main purpose of the reforms here was money. They wanted as much of it to flow back to Spain as possible, and they weren't overly concerned with the health of the colonies beyond their ability to keep providing this wealth. A good example was investment in the viceroyalty of the Rio de la Plata. We did an episode on the foundation of Buenos Aires and its subsequent abandonment. What is now Argentina, Uruguay, and Paraguay had remained backwaters, despite facing the Atlantic and Europe. The Bourbons realised that it would be more efficient to create a great port in Buenos Aires and send the silver of Potosí back to Europe through it, instead of overland through the mountains of Peru, Ecuador, and Colombia. This vast and largely unsettled area had been part of the Viceroyalty of Peru, but now a new one was created to administer the growth they envisioned there. This was more efficient, and it benefited Spain and the Rio de la Plata, but there was little concern for the colonies on the old route, which lost out on the wealth they had previously enjoyed. The Latin American-born administrators were also replaced by new ones from Spain, and Spanish industries, largely the same as those of the empire, were favoured so that Spain could have a market for its goods, rather than facing competition. We saw an example of this in the episodes on Mesoamerican food, where beer and wine were taxed in Mexico so that Spanish producers could sell them there. This led to the development of tequila. All of this was good for Spain, although it did not mean that it regained its place as the most powerful European nation, and it did help to stimulate the economy of the colonies. This stimulation was subordinate to the needs of Spain, however, and so the specific forms it took were not universally beneficial, and they created resentment. We will come back to this next episode when we deal with the Wars of Independence and their causes. There are similarities between the colonial stories of Spanish and Portuguese America. Portugal and Brazil also suffered from the same overall trend of other European powers forcing their way into the Americas. In fact, perhaps more so. We've already mentioned that France had made an attempt to found a colony in Portuguese territory. It would make a second attempt, and the Netherlands took over northern Brazil for about 20 years. Once Portugal's monarchy had separated itself from Spain after their union, the country forged an alliance with the rising power of Britain, one that still exists to this day, and which is often called the oldest still existing alliance in the world. Their story mirrored that of Spain, in that their early head start was not enough to stop them being overtaken by their rivals. They did not, however, suffer the same crisis as Spain at the end of the Habsburg era. Instead, plodding along thanks to their trade empire, something helped by their connection to Britain. They too resisted embracing the modern new ideas of Europe, because the gold from Minas Gerais propped them up, but eventually they too instituted reforms. The church was separated from the running of the empire, something which contributed to the conflict with the Jesuits, and there was a centralization of the administration. Their American capital was moved from Salvador to Rio de Janeiro. The running of Brazil was unified there, and Portuguese administrators were favoured over local ones. Monopoly companies were formed to deal with goods like sugar, similar to those which other powers were creating, such as the British East India Company. We will come back to talk about Brazil more next episode, and how its colonial experience led to a story which diverged from that of Spanish America during the independence era. But until then, thank you for listening. If you've enjoyed this episode and feel like doing something to support the podcast, something you can do which is free and quick, it's to leave a review wherever you get your podcast from. As I mentioned earlier, if you want access to extra episodes, you can sign up to become a friend of the podcast. A huge thank you to everyone who's already done one of these things.
You've been listening to the Latin American History Podcast. Written and produced by me, Max Argent. Edited by Alex McNamara. If you want to become a friend of the podcast and gain access to a bonus episode each month, as well as helping to support the running of the show, there's a link with information about how to do this in the episode description. The podcast can also be found on Facebook and Twitter by searching for the Latin American History Podcast. Here, I post updates about new episodes, as well as interesting articles I find about Latin American history. Thank you for listening.
The NFL playoffs are better with FanDuel. Because right now, new customers can bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, guaranteed. That's $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. FanDuel, an official sportsbook partner of the NFL. 21 plus and present in select states. First online real money wager only. $5 first deposit required. Bonus issued as non-withdrawable bonus bets, which expire 7 days after receipt. Restrictions apply. See terms at sportsbook.fanduel.com. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Taxes was waiting around for your taxes to be done, which led to worrying about not getting any money back. Now Taxes is matching with a TurboTax expert who can do your taxes in a day to get you up to $4,000 fast with a refund advance loan. Now this is Taxes, Intuit TurboTax. Get an expert now on TurboTax.com. Expert filing only available with TurboTax Live Full Service. Refund advance has $0 loan fees and 0% APR. Refund advance loans may be issued by First Century Bank, N.A. or Web Bank. Terms apply, subject to approval.